there was not enough kind of independent due diligence on that downstream processing, on what that was going to take, what that was going to cost. And unfortunately, that's really turned to be a black eye for the whole battery materials industry.
The Manhattan Project allowed the United States to defeat Nazi Germany.
We're going to be doing one thing and one thing only, killing Nazis.
Project Apollo put a person on the moon.
It's one small step for man.
And hastened the defeat of the Soviet Union.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Today, I think that Western supply chains are more vulnerable to China than most people realize.
Let's say China.
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 The question that I kind of have is, does the U.S. even want to stay a superpower?
China.
Welcome to the Minerals Manhattan Project. I'm your host, Emily Hirsch, and I'm joined today by Jesse Edmondson, who's the founder and CEO of U.S. Critical Minerals, and a geologist who's passionate about creating a domestic U.S. supply chain for critical minerals. Welcome to the podcast, Jesse.
Thanks, Emily. I'm happy to be here.
I'm super glad to have you here because, Jesse, you are, I think, one of the, I would say, biggest advocates for not just critical minerals mining in the United States, but also the creation of critical minerals supply chains in the United States, which, as we've discussed at length, are two very related but quite different industrial processes. But before we get into critical mineral supply chains, I kind of want to just ask you some questions about what is mineral exploration? I mean, you see these reports from the USGS and things like that showing, you know, oh, there are copper or cobalt or graphite deposits in the U.S. We have these maps. So what's with all this actual exploration work?
You ask the best questions. Like, it's just, but they're also simple. So it's like, it's all such a like, oh, wait, I was ready to, like this, let's go back to like 101. What is a rock? You know, it's like, oh, fuck, I don't know what a rock is. I can't talk about that. I don't know what a rock is. It's just.
No, but so like, if we already know where these things are, right? Like one of the things that I've heard you say yourself is like, we have all these critical minerals in the United States. So what's the point of exploration? If we know they're there, what is exploration? Explain it to me like I'm a senator, so you can't offend me.
Mineral exploration is essentially step one of the mining process. It's the discovery process. It's going out and finding an economic deposit. And so it's very much boots on the ground geology. It's mapping, it's drilling, it's geophysics, it's integrated. It's a very integrative science, which is one of the reasons why I really like it. But it's basically, it's going out and finding something and then figuring out if there's enough of it to build a mine.
I'm Senator What's-His-Face. I want to build a graphite mine. Why can't I just do it?
That's a good question. It varies based on commodity, first of all, and it varies based on the complexity of the geology from where you're at. But let's in general terms, the exploration process, no, it could actually be broken up into several stages. So the initial stage would be kind of establishment of actually just a drilling target. Let's say we're going to go look for gold in Nevada, and maybe we've got a pretty good idea of where we want to go look based on there was a past gold mine in the area, and we know that there's kind of a gold system in place. So maybe the first step of mineral exploration, it might be going out and actually doing some claim staking, so actually getting a land position. That doesn't always come first. Sometimes you like to go ahead and do some kind of reconnaissance geology reconnaissance field work first. So you might do some soil geochemistry. So you might put in a big soil grid and look for geochemical anomalies. You might do some airborne or ground geophysics to basically identify some targets of interest. So you can do, airborne surveys, you can do ground surveys, and then there's different instruments that can look at different things. Yeah, the electromagnetic response, you can look at radiometric response. So it kind of depends on what mineral you're looking at as far as what tools you're going to utilize on the geophysics side. But you're trying to build kind of a stacked data set of layers, and you want all those layers to basically point you in the right direction. You're essentially trying to build a treasure map to go and find your gold. So it's important to note that process just in itself of tying up a land position and doing that initial exploration to really figure out if it's worth spending more money to drill, it costs money and it costs time. So that process typically is something that's going to take on the order of months, maybe up to a year. And again, it kind of depends on the commodity and it depends on the terrain, but you could easily just spend a year just trying to identify what would be considered a drill target, meaning that there's enough geologic evidence based on your preliminary work to suggest that you should bring in a drilling rig and drill into the earth so you can sample more rock at depth. And so that drilling depth is determined by the geologic terrain you're in. It's determined by the commodity you're going after, and it's determined by the grade of the material. So kind of grade is king when it comes to mining. And so you can justify going deeper into the earth after a resource if the grade is really high, which would essentially, in most cases, mean you'd have to build an underground mine. So there's kind of a cutoff for staying near the surface and having an open pit mine, or going underground and building an underground mine. And that's essentially just based on the economics of, is there enough material and is it high enough grade for me to spend this massive amount of money to go underground and go get it? But that initial exploration process, it does take time, and it's extremely risky too. You know, one of the interesting kind of facts that they throw out for just being in the mineral exploration business is basically there's less than a 5% success rate of taking a project all the way into production. And so most mineral exploration does not lead to building mines. And so that's an important thing to keep in mind. And even if you're successful with exploration and you do find, let's say you find a drill target. So now our project of just being boots on the ground and mapping and doing geophysics, it's turned into, hey, we think we've got something down there, let's drill it. So let's do this a little bit as a timeline and as kind of a spending money too. So let's say that first part of putting together our land position, getting claims, doing some surface mapping, doing some surface geochemistry, and maybe we did some airborne geophysics too. You know, let's say we spent 6 to 12 months doing that, and we spent maybe $1 million. Okay, so the next phase of the project is going to be establishing, basically verifying with drilling or maybe with trenching that what you were seeing based on your surface work or based on the geophysics work, that basically that there's something to it. You know, so let's say, we've now found smoke, now we need to go find the fire. And so drilling and trenching are kind of the great truth finders. You know, you can, geologists like to speculate. We're great at speculation. We're great at having opinions, and everybody can have an opinion or speculate when a resource hasn't been drilled yet, or when an excavator hasn't opened up the earth yet. But once you've done that initial drilling to kind of decide, okay, you know, we're going after it, we've got something, let's go after it, then you would have kind of a resource drilling program. And so what I mean by that is now you really want to, you want to go after and plan the drill program in a way that really allows you to quantify and kind of qualify your resource, you know, on an economic basis. Is there enough material in the ground to build a mine? Is it going to be economic? And this is in order to kind of satisfy 43-101 requirements or JORC requirements if you're a publicly traded company. If you're a private company, you don't necessarily have to do it to the same standard, but the industry essentially requires it. And so everybody basically kind of plays by the same rules on the upstream side. And that's an important point, because remind me to make a point about the downstream and kind of the secondary process and the lack of due diligence there. But there's basically an agreed upon set of standards for determining that there is a resource in the ground. And so there's different levels of having a resource. There's an inferred resource, an indicated resource, or a measured resource. And those are essentially different tiers based on confidence limits.
So those like 43-101 and JORC standards, they come from Canada and Australia respectively. I kind of want to pivot over to the fact that, do we have standards like that that come from the United States? And do those same kinds of standards exist for coal mining, since it's been around for so long? Because one of the conversations you and I have had repeatedly is that the first thing, if you say mining in the United States, you know, it's like a association of words that go straight to coal. Does the U.S. have standards about mineral resources? And does the coal industry do anything close to what we're talking about right now?
As far as I know, the United States does not have a particular set of standards that is used on mineral exploration projects. Basically, they've adopted JORC and 43-101 compliance. And I think the main reason for that is when you come to especially like the industrial minerals and precious metals and kind of some of these other commodities outside of oil, gas, and coal, you know, the U.S. hasn't really done it for several decades in a serious manner. And so if you look at most of the mineral exploration projects in North America, they're almost, let's say, over 90% of them are either Canadian, they have a Canadian-owned parent company, or they have an Australian-owned parent company. Essentially, you know, the junior mining space, which is kind of the mineral exploration space, you know, it's a high-risk business. It does require a lot of capital. Drilling is, you know, expensive. Trenching is expensive. Building resources is expensive. And again, it's a high-risk business. And so, unfortunately, in my opinion, you know, the kind of structure of choice is becoming a publicly listed, you know, essentially penny stock company on either the Canadian exchange or the Australian exchange, and developing the project, you know, through raising money off private placement for stock offerings. And, it, you know, you can understand why that works. It's kind of the perfect promotional story. You know, we've got, you know, oh, this new commodity is hot, and, you know, we've got this new project and it's never been drilled before. And come on, folks, place your bets. You're going to hit it big. So it works for that, you know, quite well. The problem is with that is it really kind of handcuffs projects. It really handcuffs management teams that are really kind of trying to do the right thing, because it, you know, it really leaves your project vulnerable to kind of market manipulations and all these kinds of things. And so it's frustrating to be on the ground managing a project and you hit all your milestones, right? You take your investors' money, you go out, you do find a resource, you do go out and drill it. You do prove that you have an economic resource. And what typically happens is those first investors that kind of got your project off the ground, you know, they're gone. And it's not because you didn't do what you said you were going to do. It's because you did exactly what you said you were going to do. You were successful in finding a resource and you started drilling it out. And the problem is the initial bump the stock, yeah, the initial uptick that the stock gets when you've gone from a highly speculative project to, hey, these guys have got something. It's really hard to realize that value for a long time, again, in a mining project. And so there's kind of a whole group of investors that really go out there and try to profit off that initial uptick. And the problem is when you're the guy or gal on the ground trying to advance the project, you've now lost your kind of base support, even though you've kind of delivered on everything you said you were going to do. That model leaves for a lot of dilution into the stock. It leaves for a lot of, like I said, market manipulation when there's other forces outside your control. So anyway, that's a long way of saying, you know, we're kind of entrenched in the system where mineral exploration in the United States has been run by the Australians and the Canadians. And so that's kind of the standard which all the projects have adopted, even privately owned projects. And so, but most privately owned projects I know in the US, they still use 43-101 standards to kind of guide how they report.
Does coal mining do the same thing as other types of mining when it comes to that type of a process?
That's really a good question. And honestly, I you know, I guess I should know the answer to that, but I really don't. I assume that absolutely that resources have to be, well, absolutely, they're drilled out, they're quantified, they have to do bankable feasibility studies. I don't know that they've adopted 43-101 standards exactly. I'm sure if they're a publicly traded company on the Canadian exchange that they have.
Let me put this another way. Do you think that in the U.S., and maybe we can research this together for fun, but are the coal companies in the U.S. owned by the U.S., whereas other mining companies are owned on other markets?
A lot of coal companies in the U.S. are U.S. owned. And a lot of them are old companies, too. I mean, that's worth pointing out. You know, a lot of the bigger coal companies have been around, you know, for decades and decades. And so there's kind of a long legacy. A lot of times they've been passed down through families, through several generations. Like I said, I should know with regards to the resource compliance and how they do that. It's a good question. I don't know. But, you know, I would almost say that they've kind of grandfathered in they're probably their own way of doing things. But, you know, it's absolutely, there's still an incredible amount of science that goes into it. It's not just, you know, a bunch of hillbillies with the excavator that start ripping away at it and just start coal mining. There's a method that they stick to, no doubt.
One of the things I kind of had my, like, a mind blown moment was when you and I were together in Washington, D.C., and I learned that there's no Minister of Mining in the United States, and that sort of part of, you know, mining rights are under the Bureau of Land Management, but that's only for public land. But then when it comes to private land, you explained to me that because in the U.S. surface rights come with mineral rights, but many of those mineral rights were sold off in the Great Depression and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that when it comes to non-public land, sorting out who those mineral rights belong to can be quite the escapade, which reminded me more of a developing country, to be honest, than what I would expect in the United States. And I kind of want to just, like, what's the difference in the United States between private and public land when it comes to mining?
That's a good question. So, yeah, essentially, if you look at a map of the United States, essentially, you know, most of the land east of the Mississippi is private land. Most of the land west of Mississippi is public land. Just, you know, very general terms, that's essentially the case. It speaks to the history of you know, westward expansion in the United States to a large degree. So if you've got private land, the way that works is essentially those mineral rights travel with the surface rights initially. So, and this goes all the way back to like the early land grants. And so you were given a deed for the surface and you were given a deed for the mineral rights. And then in places in the Western United States, we've talked about too, you know, water rights are further separated. In some places you can own your surface rights and your mineral rights, but not own your water rights or kind of any combination of those.
Jesse, I want to kind of circle back to what we were talking about when you were explaining about mineral exploration. You know, I think that something that most people who aren't in mining don't really understand is that, you know, the U.S. Geological Survey or other geologists don't have some kind of magical, perfect underground map of where everything is. And so kind of circling back to when you talked about like, okay, these are preconditions. This is where we know where to start trenching or where to start drilling. I, as a wannabe geologist, know that kind of like the age of the earth is important. You know, the older the earth bits that you can kind of dig up, the more likely you are to find cool rocks. And one of the things you and I've talked about is how, you know, in the Southeast, and so you and I've talked about how the Southeast is coal country. It's kind of it's the continuation of the Appalachians. I don't know, like, are the Appalachians an old enough mountain range to find the coolest rocks? You've talked about some of the work you've done with kind of like aging trees that are found there. Are there any correlations between that? Like, why is the Southeast geologically interesting? I mean, if you were to ask me, I'd be like, Rocky Mountains, those are very big, geologically interesting. But what does the Southeast have? You know, that's where the coal country is. Give me some info.
The Southeast, particularly, yeah, the southern end of the Appalachians. So Alabama, like north, east central, northeast Alabama, north Georgia, western South Carolina, eastern Tennessee, you know, is the southern extension of the Appalachians. They are old mountains. They're, you know, billion plus year old rocks. And, you know, you're right. I mean, when you do have old rocks or you've got an old geologic terrain, you've created a lot of opportunities for cool stuff to happen. So the longer you've been around, you know, the more things you've seen, the more stories you've got to tell, the more battle scars you've got, all that fun stuff. And so the Southeast, you know, being on that southern end of the Appalachians, it is super old rock. There's been up to at least 7 different deformation events. So that means basically mountains, you know, land masses colliding with one another, faulting happening, folding happening. And so it is a structurally complex geologic area. There are old rocks. There's been several episodes of mineralization depending upon where you're at in the Appalachians. And so it's a good place to look. And as far as kind of the history of mineral exploration in the United States that I think is interesting is, you know, there was a lot of activity back in the late 1700s, early 1800s, looking for, you know, different metals, looking for gold. You know, there was actually quite a bit of gold exploration work in the Carolinas, in Georgia, in Alabama, and they actually found quite a bit. But when the kind of California gold rush happened, people pretty much packed their bags and headed west by and large. And so that was actually, in my opinion, really good for Jesse, because that means that there's a lot of rocks that have been unturned in the southeast and in the Appalachians.
So Jesse, going over from commodities like gold to what we're calling critical minerals, you know, I think I come into the critical mineral space vis-a-vis lithium. You know more than most people I know about both rare earths and graphite. And one of the things that sort of I've seen in lithium is that, you know, everyone and their mom has a lithium discovery because guess what? it's not that difficult to discover some lithium somewhere. You know, technically the ocean is a lithium deposit. And you and I have had a number of conversations about why critical minerals differ from things like gold, in that there's a sort of a value add step or a processing step. And I would love you to kind of talk me through why that makes it a better case to do some of these, not just mineral extraction, but some of these processes in the United States.
Most of the critical minerals do not have spot markets. And so that's kind of the first important thing to point out is, and so what I mean by that is basically there's not a guaranteed price that you can go look up every day, you know, on an app or on your computer. You know, you can't go down to the pawn shop and sell graphite, you know, unfortunately. I've tried it, they won't take it. It makes placing a value, doing economic studies and economic analysis a little more difficult. Yeah, the value is basically determined by your contracts with your end users.
But one of the things that's kind of, I think that there's a critical difference to understand between with a lot of these critical minerals and the way that these minerals get from the ground into technology is this processing step that I think gets missed.
So yeah, it's important to note that with most of these critical minerals is when they come out of the mine and when they come out, you know, when they come out of the ground, they come out of the mine, you know, they're not technology ready. And so that's an important point. And the other point is that when you look at most of these projects as well, if you look at just the mining process and so just that process of getting the rock, getting it out of the ground, and creating a concentrate of graphite or of lithium or of rare earths, getting to the point of that concentrate, you know, while depending on the commodity, it is a sellable material, it's not very attractive economically. And so if you look at most of these new kind of aspiring critical mineral projects, is they require the mining component, they require the processing component. And most of the aspiring companies that are trying to do this, they do have these aspirations of being vertically integrated. And what I mean by that is they're doing the mining themselves, and then they are making the technology-ready materials themselves. And the thing is, you know, if you're a mining company, you're not an advanced materials company. And so those are two different expertise. And I think a lot of the mining companies have tried to kind of just assume that they could immediately break in to these new kind of tech markets. And, you know, it's complicated. And it's not that they can't, but I think it's that a lot of them have rushed the process. A lot of them have underestimated the complexities, you know, with doing so. And a lot of them, you know, have really fallen short of properly developing, you know, their process. So, you know, having the proper amount of kind of independent due diligence, making sure that at every step of the way that this process is being de-risked. And so, you know, one thing I mentioned earlier that I did want to come back to is when it comes to drilling out a resource and proving that, okay, we've got enough graphite to make a mine. You know, there's a very well-established set of standards for which that is done and for which that is independently evaluated. To where when it's basically given its stamp of approval as an indicated resource or a measured resource by 43-101 standards in Canada or JORC compliant in Australia, everybody generally accepts that, hey, this is, you know, this is in the ground, this is there, they've done everything they needed to do. And basically there's a great level of comfort what you've got. But when you come to that second part of really the engineering, the material science, the conversion of taking a run-of-mine material into a technology-ready material, that's a whole nother process. And in many cases, it's way more complicated. But unfortunately, what's happened to date with a lot of these aspiring companies and massive projects is they've really cut corners on that secondary processing and the engineering for that. And so we've seen a lot of failures. So point in case, Nemaska Lithium, which was, you know, a hard rock spodumene project in Quebec, which looked great. Everybody liked it. It's a great deposit. The Canadian government was behind it. A lot of, you know, kind of critical investors were behind it. Yet it fell short. And, you know, now it's kind of really coming to light is they really just, there was not enough kind of independent due diligence on that downstream processing, on what that was going to take, what that was going to cost. And unfortunately, that's really turned to be a black eye for the whole battery materials industry.
It sounds like there's kind of a need to have an understanding of kind of the upside versus the downside. Like what you're explaining to me sounds like you know, we all know there's an upside to domestic supply chains. We all know there's an upside from a carbon footprint standpoint. We all know there's an upside from a supply chain security standpoint. But then from an individual basis or from a company by company basis, you know, there's very little upside with a lot of downside in taking some of these risks to get from where we are to where we want to be.
Yeah, the only other thing that I was just going to mention with regard to qualification that's important is so, you know, I'm Jesse trying to sell Emily graphite. Emily makes really nice batteries. You're going to, if I approach you and I say, hey, I'm a new graphite company, you know, we're working on building this project out. We're in the late stages of development. You know, we're going to, you know, we're on track to be in production in 18 months or in 24 months or whatever it is. You're going to say, okay, well, that's really interesting. And maybe as kind of a being nice or to kind of say, okay, let's kick the can a little bit. Let's see what this guy's got. You'll agree to take an evaluation sample from me and I'll send that to you, meeting your spec requirements. And so that's another quick thing that I should mention is that every single one of these battery companies or technology companies, when you're looking at all these different critical minerals, is everybody has a different technical specification that they want for their technology. So it's not like everybody agrees that we all want this graphite at this size and this purity. No, everybody's got their own kind of requirements. And so as the producer, you've got to kind of figure out, okay, you can't make a customized material for everybody. So you've got to kind of figure out, okay, what's going to be middle of the road enough that enough people are going to be interested in it. But then, so once I say, okay, well, I've got this material that meets your technical specifications. Would you like a sample? You say, yes. I send that to you, and then you do some just initial testing, and you come back to me, and you say, hey, you know, this is pretty good material. I liked it. It performed well. We'd like to test some more, and we'd like to know kind of when you're going to be in production. And that's when it gets really complicated and when it's really hard to move forward because, you know, it takes time and money and, you know, manpower on the battery company side to test this material for their technology. And again, it's a risk for them to take on a new material. And that qualification process of really getting your material accepted, it's a lengthy process. It at least takes 2 to 3 years in most cases for lithium ion batteries. And even longer if you're talking about some of the different EVs, if you're talking about aerospace defense stuff, you know, it can even be longer than that. It can be a 5 to 7 year process of getting qualified. And then the problem is that you really can't begin the qualification process until you're actually in at least small scale production on site, making your product with your equipment at your mine site. And so that's a really important point and a really important hurdle for all these projects to cross is because, so again, it's this chicken or the egg situation where I can say, well, if you can just, you know, Emily, if you will just sign an offtake agreement with me that says you're going to buy, you know, X amount of graphite at this price, then I can take that back to my investor and get him to write me a check to put this thing into production. And you say, well, you know, I'm really not willing to do that until I know when you're going to get into production. And so again, it just creates a situation where it's a kind of a standoff. But, and I think, you know,
well, it's quality and consistency, right? Like, totally. So there's these quality specs, but you also have to say, not only do I produce this quality, but I do it consistently.
I do it every time. What's important for all these every materials time. Too, is so you've got to have a, you know, high purity material, but it's not only that your material, it's not only how pure your material is, it's what are the impurities. And so again, let's talk about graphite. So minimum battery grade graphite is considered 99.95% pure carbon. But I might have 3 different graphites that all are 99.95% carbon, and every single one of those 3 graphites might have different problematic elements in that remaining 0.05%. So just because I can achieve the 99.95, that does not mean that I'm meeting all your requirements for, let's say, molybdenum or vanadium or iron or sulfur. So given the element and given the exact technology, so it can be different for different companies. It can be different for like alkaline battery guys versus rechargeable lithium guys versus primary lithium guys. Everybody's got kind of different thresholds for what's acceptable. But what's important is not only is my 99.95% consistent every time, it's also important that, you know, that molybdenum number or that vanadium number or whatever, that iron number is pretty much always right where it's supposed to be. And so all that stuff really matters. And again, it's this kind of chicken or the egg situation where, you know, it's hard to kind of get in production at a small scale without kind of having those offtake agreements in place. Because, you know, even building like a small scale commercial demonstration plant, I mean, that's going to cost, you know, millions of dollars. And it's kind of a hard sell to investors to just say, hey, we need you to build us this demonstration plant. The demonstration plant itself isn't going to really bring positive cash flow, but it's going to basically be this necessary building block for us to be able to move our project and company forward. And so it's kind of, you know, it's kind of a tough sell. You know, the only graphite company that is moving forward right now in North America is Nouveau Monde in Quebec.
Some good French you got there, Jesse.
Yeah, I've got, you know, pretty good for an Arkansas boy. Sorry about that, Eric. But, you know, my hat's off to those guys because those guys have done a great job developing their project. And they got support from the Quebec government to kind of say, hey, this is important for our country. This is important, you know, for electric vehicles, for green energy. And so they've really gotten behind the project, and that's allowed them to kind of get the funding for a commercial demonstration plant. And so, again, the only project that really looks like it's probably going to, or at least the first to go into production in graphite in North America, the first new mine to go in production is probably going to be those guys. And it's because, you know, they built that commercial demonstration plant, and they've done a lot of other things right too, but that's absolutely necessary to really get qualified, to get the offtake agreements, to really get the funding to get into production.
I kind of hope that one of the changes in attitude that comes out of the coronavirus, everyone quarantined, is a deeper understanding of where things come from and these steps that kind of have to happen. These corners, if you will, that cannot be cut. They can look to, I guess, foment or generate more energy and more excitement and more interest in developing some of these critical mineral supply chains from the mine all the way through some of these technology applications with at least more of the important components in the U.S. So listen, Jesse, if people want to find you on the social media, where can they do that?
I'm on the social media. So I'm on LinkedIn. Just look me up, Jesse Edmondson. I'm on Twitter. I don't tweet a lot, but I might start tweeting more. I can't remember my Twitter handle, but I'm Jesse Edmondson.
You know what? I pulled it up. It's @Jesse_Edmondson on Twitter. Yeah, Jesse, I hope that you will come back to the Minerals Manhattan podcast sooner rather than later so that we can talk about some of these other exciting critical minerals topics, especially as they relate to the Southeast.
The Minerals Manhattan Project is hosted by Emily Hirsch and produced by Emily Hirsch and Elena Peach. To continue today's conversation, follow Emily on Twitter @LithiumPodcast and visit our website @batterymaterials.energy. Enjoyed today's episode? Please share with others and rate the Minerals Manhattan Project on wherever you get your podcasts. Have content suggestions or interested in being featured as a guest in a future episode? Please contact us via our website or the Twitters.